The decision for the San Miguel operation was actually made by Foch, who was the supreme commander at that time. As I recall, he specified three operations that he wanted carried out first. This was his beginning of the offensive following the Soissons fight, which stopped the German advance. That occurred July 18th to 21st of that summer. And for the first time, the German army started to the rear, and this was the army of the German Crown Prince. I don't remember where the attack was to be on the English front, nor do I remember exactly where it was to be on the French front. I know they all referred to communications. And on the American front, it was the San Miguel operation, because the Germans held the point, which consisted really of the town of San Miguel and the high ground that came down the Meuse River from the north of San Miguel. If that was obliterated, then the communications to Paris by railroad were free all along, all parallel to the entire front. I'm sorry I can't remember where the French operation was to be or where the British operation was to be, but they all were carried out. Just how the San Miguel was to be carried out, just where the attack was to be launched, it was another matter, and that was for General Pershing's decision. The whole thing was how you would do this thing in order to free the railroad. I was put to work on this, and I've always been rather embarrassed by the fact that I submitted a number of different plans, none of them, you might say, conclusive. The trouble was that I was first given the problem of how to do this with so many divisions. I've forgotten now how many. We will say 7. And, of course, that's one thing, working it out with 7 divisions. Then they changed this and added 2 more, which altered the possibilities for the operation decidedly. And it was changed again. It was changed 4 times to finally this large number of divisions which came up. I've even forgotten how many it was now, which determined the final operation, particularly the fact that we would attack from both flanks instead of from just one. That was a lead-up from the American point of view to the San Miguel operation. And considering the troops in many cases were pretty raw, and so many of the, and that the Army headquarters were brand new, and that's a very complicated institution, incidentally, I think they did very well. Stop it and start it again. I see on the next page in paragraph 10 the answer to several of the doubtful points I had just mentioned. One was the indication of where the British and the French and the English, the British and the French offensives were to be, and another were the number of divisions that were participating in the San Miguel operation itself. There's some comment there on the troop movement. As a matter of fact, the original concentration was not such a unusual thing. It was a big concentration, but it had to be carried out at night, of course, which made it a congested affair. The really great concentration occurred later on, before the end of the battle, and out of its rear area, and over to the left for the lineup of the San Miguel. That lineup for the Meuse-Argonne. That was a terrific problem of logistics, and it had to be met in many ways, and we managed to carry it out successfully. I had Walter Grant to assist me through this. I've already mentioned the planning of the Samuel. I came into that battle first on the basis of the planning. And then Walter Grant and I were called up from Chaumont by General Drum to check on the plans that had already been made by his permanent G3. I was not a G3 at that time. For the concentration, we checked over all their orders and plans, and they were perfectly sound. Then they were the permanent G3 and G5, I think, which was the head of the training staff, were withdrawn without any explanation being made, and I was put in charge of the San Miguel operation so far as the staff was concerned. I didn't know at all where the others had gone, and I didn't ask any questions. I was too busy. So from that time on, with Walter Grant to assist me, I was busy with the conduct of the San Miguel operation. And it was not until... And it went off pretty well. It went off very well, as a matter of fact. I think we could have gone a little further at the end if the... Division, the corps commanders had followed out the orders. The order provided that when they got to the line rigidly specified, specifically outlined, and there was any opportunity to go forward, they should send forward battalions with some artillery and reconnaissance units and push ahead as fast as they could. They didn't do this. In one division, this was proposed, and that was done by Douglas MacArthur, who was chief of staff of the 42nd Division, and he wanted to push right on at that time. The trouble was, none of the others had gathered themselves, and General Drum and the army commander thought we should leave well enough alone. Undoubtedly, if they had pushed on, they'd gone much closer to Metz at the first lunge. However, if they already had authority to organize a battalion or a regiment in the division and push ahead with that, but they didn't do that. Of course, it was their first big battle, and there's always much confusion, and there was always much uncertainty as to what the exact conditions were, which is to be carefully considered when you're trying to judge whether you did this just right or not. Didn't have a Stonewall Jackson who had been experienced in many fights already. The complications now began. I've been concerned now with the full battle. Now suddenly I was called over to headquarters, which is across the street, and they outlined the Meuse-Argonne. That's the first I'd ever heard of it. And that's what the other fellows on the staff had been working on, the plan for the deployment for the Meuse-Argonne and the initial plan for the battle. I was told to concentrate the troops, and I was given the lineup that they would have in the battle. That was my first intimation of the Meuse-Argonne battle. I went back over to look into this thing, and it was there had been no warning at all. Here I suddenly found the list of the divisions that were to be in the battle, what lineup they were to have, and my job was to get them in the battle, which involved not just an ordinary concentration, because most of these divisions had to come out from reserve and support positions in the Meuse-Argonne battle, which was still going. And added to that, had to go perpendicular to the direction of the troops in the rear areas of the San Miguel. In other words, they had to go to the west while the San Miguel troops were all headed due north. That meant a cross-cut of traffic. And the special army and corps troops, artillery, tanks, engineers, signal troops, everything of that sort, had to be located and drawn out of the battle to move over to the Meuse-Argonne front. A great many of these were French, and we had a great deal of trouble with them because they were tired. They were tired when they got there from the fighting, and they were now very tired from the San Miguel thing, and now we were starting off to move them to a new battle. and we had quite a hard time moving them. We had a hard time finding them in the first place in the general confusion of the hundreds of thousands of troops involved here, and they didn't move very promptly, as was to be expected from very tired, heavily used troops. However, we got this movement started. At first, it had to be handled in extreme detail to prevent a complete confusion on the Meuse-Argonne front. Walter Grant was a great help to me in this. That was the most difficult troop movement I ever imagined. And we had some trucks or buses that the French had given us, enough to carry the foot troops of one division. Our complication there was the trucks moved at one speed, the machine gun carts moved at another speed, the tanks moved at another speed, and it was a very difficult thing with only one or two roads going around the point and up to the north, and going entirely at night to get this in such a fashion that they could manage without confusion. I remember with some amusement an incident that occurred there in the office. The chief of staff of a division, and was the first division incidentally, came in to consult with me about the order that they had just received, and also to answer some questions as to what others might do. What was going on there was that the advance in the battle had been such an extent that there was a possibility of the division cutting across the salient in the valley of the CRUE. But we didn't know how clear that was. None of us had ever been through the place. But it would be a tremendous saving in the movement of the machine gun carts and the movement of the artillery and the movement of the trucks, if they could get through. We were discussing this, and I was changing the orders around in a fashion to do it the way he thought they might be able to do it in the 1st Division, and he was able to tell me where the troops were at that moment in the battle, because they'd played a leading part in the battle and had moved a great deal, and now it was a question of just exactly where they were located and how they could be turned into the Valley of the Creux. At the same time, there was an old friend of mine, a much older officer. He'd been a student officer when I was an instructor at Leavenworth. And as I say, he was an old friend of mine. He had just landed in France and had the good luck to be sent up to that front to be the town major of the town of Bar-le-Duc. He sat there and listened to this chief of staff of the 1st Division and myself going over this and changing the orders around to meet just what the chief of staff of the division thought could be done, and then he hurried back to rejoin the division with his newly modified orders, largely at his suggestion. After he left the room, this newly arrived officer in France, this coming town major of Bar-le-Duc, this old friend of mine, he said, "May I make a comment?" Well, I said, "Certainly you can make a comment. Why shouldn't you make a comment?" Well, he said, "This, you might be offended." Oh, I said, "No, I won't be offended. I might be relaxed by it." Well, he said, "I want just to observe that when orders are issued, they're supposed to be obeyed and not to be discussed and changed." Well, as the orders he had worked with had probably never exceeded a regiment, and probably most of his life had been a battalion or a company, we were now talking about hundreds of thousands of troops, general confusion over the roads, another big battle pending, and it was a rather absurd, to be expected comment. I was always sort of amused with this because he was a very pedantic sort of a fella, and if we had done that, we'd have wrecked ourselves about every 20 minutes. However, that's the way we were getting started in this thing, this troop movement to the Meuse-Argonne, and I was interested in having illuminated signs made at some of the great crossroads so that the marches at night could be better coordinated. I started to talk about the trucks, which were a very important part. There were enough trucks for the foot troops, or at least the two infantry brigades of the divisions. Of course, the machine gun carts were free of that. They'd have to go on another column, the 37 millimeter gun and trench mortar outfits, and of course the horses of the artillery and all the trains. Well, it is a very, very complicated affair, and these trucks were invaluable to us, but they were controlled by fascist headquarters, by a major who was in charge of all of them. So we would run these truck drivers through with a whole foot troops of a division and then have to bring them back. Well, the trouble was these fellows were desperately in need of rest because they'd been up in the center there on the French front, moving desperately to get the troops around for these offensives that are being carried out. And now they were in this thing day and night. They had two men on the driver's seat. One would sleep while the other drove. Now the great question was where they could eat. And we had great trouble getting them fed. We had some American staff officers who didn't understand this thing and didn't comprehend at all what was going on, that kicked about these Frenchmen coming in to get some food. And we had to deal very drastically with them to wake up to the fact we couldn't move our troops unless we fed these drivers. And also, if they had an hour or two to give them a place to sleep, though most of them could sleep in the trucks. Well, this went on until some of the trucks were taken away from us and called back to the French. And we had only enough for about a brigade and a half. So they were put at the disposal of this division, which was to start its move, and the division commander wanted to move a complete brigade. He had the trucks for a complete brigade, but he also had the trucks for about a half a brigade. As he liked to move a brigade at a time, he didn't use these trucks, or promptly the French reclaimed them, so we just lost about seat places for about 4,000 or 5,000 men. I guess more than that. Well, that was a calamity. And the division commander came in about that time, and he told me he was a very fine officer, and I liked him very much, but he didn't understand this business. It was brand new to him, and he'd made a fateful decision. And when he came in and told me that he wanted to move his division as a unit, so he wouldn't split this brigade, and he had would not be able to use those trucks until the first brigade of trucks came back. When I informed him we'd lost all those trucks, and if General Pershing ever heard that, he'd never forgive him, and he'd done a very, very serious thing, and he was completely flabbergasted and very much concerned and frightened. But he showed complete lack of acquaintance with how these things churn out in a great affair of this character, and they would try to do it like it is done on a piece of paper or a map. Well, we had all sorts of things like that going on, and we got through with the matter, the affair. We had to go up into the French army there and have them take the troops in the last phase of this march and the last phase of this concentration, and then these French troops had to come back, and the concentration finally got into shape roughly in time. Unfortunately, just the day before the battle, there was a raid by the Germans, and they captured some French prisoners who were put in front of the Americans in the advanced trenches, and some Americans too, I think. I was terribly distressed over this because it meant to me the Germans would know we were coming in an attack. When I spoke to General Drum about it, he said, well, we're not certain about this, and he called up General Craig, who was my predecessor, Chief of Staff, and who was then Chief of Staff of the First Corps, and he called him by his first name, Malin. He said, how about that? How about those prisoners from that raid on your First Corps front? And Malin replied, there weren't any prisoners taken. And I remember Drum saying, Malin, you're a joy forever, and turned to me and said, there weren't any prisoners. Well, I said, Drum, how do you know that? Well, he said, he just told me. And I said, how does he know it? Well, he said, they told him. Well, I said, how do any of them know it except in that first leading battalion? Well, they won't know whether they lost prisoners or not till late tonight. I had been with troops for pretty near a year then, and I knew what great difficulty it was getting any information from the advanced platoons back to the regimental headquarters. Once it got to regimental headquarters, it could be very quickly telephoned or telegraphed back. And the minute it got from there to the division, to the corps, to the army, was all a very quick procedure. But getting that front trench back to the regimental headquarters was a long, long affair. And sometimes it would take all day before you got your correct information. Sure enough, there were prisoners taken. And it's presumed that the Germans had some intimation that the attack was coming. However, it didn't do any great harm, except that we didn't go as far as we thought we should go. As a matter of truth, these men advanced very well at the start. Then they got into these dugouts, and then they got after souvenirs. They went in the dugout for a German, in a sense, and then stayed for a souvenir. And the whole advance lost its momentum. And the Germans very quickly readjusted themselves and put up a vicious defense from there on. Matter of fact, if the troops could have been kept together and have gone straight ahead, they probably could have gone as far that first day as we made in the first month. Because we fought a very desperate battle with the Germans after that time, after that halt or loss of momentum. I think your comment there about this troop movement that they refer to as being one of the recognized at the time, and the judgment has stood through the years as the most magnificent staff operation in the war, referred to the Meuse-Argonne concentration and not to the Saint-Mihiel, because the Saint-Mihiel was not so complicated. Going back to the planning for the Saint-Mihiel, I never saw the plans for the tactical deployment until the fight had started, because I was entirely absorbed in the concentration of the troops, getting the army lined up for the fight. I knew the positions they should be in, and my job was to get them in those positions. After that, I saw for the first time the plan for the battle, which was then underway. And a few days later, the chief of operations of the army was relieved, and I was put in his place. And that came just at the time there was an order to send some divisions to Belgium and to send to replace other troops that were going to Italy, where there had been a necessity for troops. But it was very hard to get these troops out and on their way up to Belgium to join the army up there. In all of these, at this time, in the early part of the battle, most of our special units were French. But during the battle, the newly arriving American troops came in so that we could replace a great many of these French units by American units. I'm talking about engineer units and special artillery units and tank units and things of that sort. Once we got into the battle, the great problem was to resume the advance. The division on the left, the division next to the Meuse-Argonne Forest, got into trouble, and the 1st Division had to be hurried out of a support position and carried up to the front. They had to travel more or less off the road, over these deep trenches, and with the machine gun carts and all, it was a very difficult thing to do. No man's land was some kilometers in width, and was a morass that didn't look like there was a space 10 yards square that hadn't been struck by a great shell. And it was a morass. There were no trace of the roads left at all, except the Route Nationale, and there was some trace there, but in the retirement from a German attack, the Italians had blown up the road so successfully, we had a terrible time getting around the crater. So it was the crossing of no man's land and getting the artillery across that was so very difficult and so very important. One commander who had previously lost his regiment for some long time back and now had it again, he didn't have a light regiment this time. He had 155 millimeter regiment of these heavy guns. And he hastened up and on his own initiative crossed no man's land, and the weight of these guns completely wiped out this very poorly ballasted trail that we'd made across no man's land and set them a fair back about a day and a half, which was a great tragedy at the time as we were trying to get light artillery across and supporting troops across. There was the confusion that you would expect in newly engaged divisions, in a newly organized army, in a mixed army of French and Americans, and the French very, very tired, and the Americans very, very cocky. We worked it out, finally got well settled, but we had a very desperate battle on the left of the army up towards the town of Exermont. And there the 1st Division suffered terrific casualties. They had already suffered very heavy casualties at Soissons, and now they took an awful beating because they had advanced and continued to advance for quite a distance when they were being shot at from the rear across the valley towards the Meuse-Argonne forest. And then occurred the effort to release the lost battalion, and that could only be done by getting in behind the Germans, which was finally managed, and the relief brought to those hard-pressed troops, which had gained great fame by their predicament. We finally came up against the, you might call the Northern Line, and there we got ready for the great attack of which led up to Sedan. And I've forgotten how many divisions took off in that, but we tried to get them rested a little bit, and in order to do that we had to hold the other divisions in line when they were just tired to death, but there was no other way to manage it. And it was very necessary to go and see the division commanders and see the regimental commanders. And some of them, the regiments had lost all organization and were just groups of men, but they had to hold on and they fought on so that these partially rested divisions could go forward in the final attack on November 1st, I think it was, which led up to the heights finally above Sedan. You asked the question if the Meuse-Argonne planning was the toughest. Well, I wasn't in the initial planning. I was only in the planning day by day, though we tried to make it cover a week's prospects at least, though it was so very difficult to do it with these tired divisions and the constant changes in the battle front due to the necessary withdrawal of French troops and the induction of brand new American units of the smaller type, not of the divisional type. However, we managed to get the November 1st attack off, though, as I say, before it, it was the great problem was to hold these other tired, exhausted, heavily suffering troops in line long enough to line up the other troops, partially rested, to have an organized attack. And it was a great relief, a great joy to all of us, when the center of the attack carried to the heights of Bathamol, I think. I don't know if that's the big ridge in the center of the attack or not, but I know they said Foch was very much delighted when the word came in of their capture. Then the fight went up towards the Saint-Mihiel, towards the Sedan front, and we almost stopped fighting the Germans then. It became a battle between the 1st Division and the 42nd Division, who had the right of way and who got to the place first. I think they're still fighting that. I would go up to the battlefront, and it was very hard to get up there on account of the traffic. And then after you got across no man's land, the only way you could do was get on a horse and go up there that way. And I did that. I did that at General Drum, who was chief of staff of the army. And of course, we had a great deal of our debating while we were riding. I remember one night, we were coming from Verdun. We'd started the battle on that wing, and we wanted to go across until we struck the famous Rue Nationale, Rue de Sacrevilla, which is the great road that supplied the French army during the Battle of Verdun. We wanted to get back to Souilly, S-O-U-I-L-L-Y, the army headquarters. We were so busy talking that the chauffeur went by this point, and I came to by recognizing some other point way to the west. So we turned around and went back. We went all the way back almost to the vicinity of Verdun and started again and began talking again. And again we talked by the turnoff, and the man went by that, and we went way over to the west again. We had to turn around and come back, and we never hit it till the third time. And we got home about 2 in the morning. Great trouble here was keeping the various organizations along the front really aware of what was happening at other portions of the front, because each one thought he was the only one who was having this desperate situation, when as a matter of fact, everyone was having it pretty much. And we were now getting into some French troops over towards the Verdun front, where we had both Americans and French. The Germans had hard luck on this front. They had had a Italian division, and several Italian divisions, as I recall, over on the Austrian divisions on that front, and they were a little bit leery about them. And as you will recall, the Austrians surrendered first, and so they kept some Germans there to stiffen up the Austrian front, which was to the east and northeast of Verdun. Nothing happened on that front at all, so they withdrew the German divisions that were stiffening up the Austrians, and the next day we attacked on that front, and the Austrians just pretty largely folded up and let us make a considerable advance. I remember there was a corps of French troops, Moroccan divisions, including the Foreign Legion, etc. And the chief of staff of this corps had been the chief of staff of the Moroccan division with the Foreign Legion when I witnessed the Battle of Verdun the previous August. He came in to see about a change of the orders, just understanding the orders that is going on his corps up near the Verdun front. And he made the remark to me, he said, "I've never seen anything like this. It's change, change, change." And I said, "Are you talking about the American staff?" And he said, "Yes." Well, I said, "I heard you myself say when you were with the Moroccan division that the French staff changed, changed, changed. It was a guerre de papier and a guerre de changement. And now you're accusing us of it." And he laughed. He says, "Yes, that's about true." But he says, "I think you better make a better job of changing. I don't mean you change better, but you make a better job of changing frequently than even the French did." I know he was so astonished to find me. I was a captain when I went through the fight with the Foreign Legion. And now here, just a year later, I was chief of operations of an army that had almost 1 million men in it. Such procedure as that was unknown to the French army. You asked for comments on the famous episode of the 1st Division and the 42nd Division and General Summerall and General Dickman and the French. Theodore Roosevelt got in front of his old regiment, I think it's the 16th Infantry, and pushed on as hard as he could, and he had to walk with the staff because he had this knee that had been shot up. And I'd gotten him back for command of the thing, and he was held to be absent without leave from his unit he was assigned to in the south of France. But he was going with his old regiment and making a fine job of leadership. And all of this got complicated up on the front. And when he went through the French line, they were lying down, and he barged on through to head for Sedan. And they rushed up and protested that they were, it was their sector. Well, he said, "You aren't advancing." And he went right along. And when they discovered he was Theodore Roosevelt, then they all stood up and cheered him, and he went on ahead. The fight between Summerall and Dickman was very intense, and it went back to all sorts of jealousies. And the real factors in the case were largely ignored. And it kept on in a senseless way for almost the rest of their services. The addition of the words "boundaries will not be considered binding," I didn't put it in, but it was boundaries couldn't be binding to carry out what we told them to do, which was the center corps to support the corps on its left, which was the first corps, and you couldn't get over there and support that corps without crossing your boundary on the left to do it. John thought it was essential to put it in, and we put it in, but that was always used as the argument on the Summerall side, and I don't know how the Dickman crowd called that, but the thing was rather senseless. And it started off with a jealousy. They were jealous of General Summerall's great reputation he had made in the hard fighting, and the whole thing, to my mind, was out of place. The thing was, we were succeeding. We weren't there to fight each other. There were going to be all sorts of turbulence on the battlefield. And this thing was carried back to old animosities. I didn't have very much patience with it. But I wasn't the one that was receiving the animosity. Of course, the French exploded because they were standing still. And these other troops went through them. I've told you the episode of Roosevelt. The 42nd Division troops that had gotten almost the heights of Sedan, of course, they got mad. Well, I can understand that in a way. But nevertheless, all of them could get together and do something rather than shoot at each other, which they almost did. The fellow that released General MacArthur, that is, identified him, was Jalmer, H-J-A-L-M-E-R, Jalmer Erickson, who was in command of a brigade in the 1st Division. And he was out on the road there, and he identified him and believed him. Of course, there were all kinds of confusion all over the place. The main thing was that General MacArthur's up there trying to press the attack and get it ahead when this thing occurred. In to paragraph 12, the details about the assignments are correct. Well, as to the victory parade, I don't know quite how to describe that. It was a magnificent affair. And, of course, it was a magnificent occasion. And it was the first passage of the Arc de Triomphe since the Franco-Prussian War. And therefore, a very historic occasion. The most beautiful effect in the parade was when we turned up towards the Rue Royale, I guess, turned up towards the Madeleine. And behind the great pillars of the Madeleine, they had dropped red velvet curtains, and it gave a wonderful effect. I remember the photograph you referred to. Stimson, a fellow named Murphy, and two other very prominent men who were had temporary commissions had a mess to themselves. I've forgotten for the moment who the other two are. One was later a partner, was at that time a partner at J.P. Morgan and Company, and died rather young later on. I've forgotten his name. Stimson and I went horseback riding, and he talked, of course, of all. He talked at the mess about these things, and he talked a great deal on the horse about it. Later on, I saw Stimson before this, or I guess I saw him later when he was sent back home to be promoted from a lieutenant colonel to a colonel and put in charge of one of the new regiments. He didn't get back in time for the final blows. Of course, my meeting with Stimson led to other things. When I was at Benning, I remember I was playing tennis, I got a telegram in which he wanted me to go to the Philippines with him, and while he didn't say it in the telegram, it was to be the prospective brigadier general and head of the constabulary. But I declined. I was trying to get away from staff jobs, though I was much complimented by his request. I think I've described the opera. I was not in Paris during the session of the peace conference. I came to know France pretty well, in certain sections, of course. I knew the people. I knew particularly the country people, the peasantry. I'd lived with them. And various parts of the country I came to know exceedingly well. North, east of Beauvais, up towards... I've forgotten the name now. And... of course, around Nancy and Tours and that section of France, Lunéville, later on the district of Beaune, and of course around Paris and Chaumont and Long. I might tell of a very interesting affair that occurred at... Long, where they had the staff school. They had to depend almost entirely on French and British instructors. And there was some little jealousy there among them. And there was a preference of one crowd for the British instructor and of another crowd for the French instructor. Largely, if those that spoke a little French, understood French, would favor the French instructors. The others favored the British instructors. Anyway, they were doing their best to get ahead without having their own talent for the purpose. I came in there as being the first officer they'd had at the school to lecture or anything who had been on the staff and doing operations on the American side. And therefore, I was brought back to talk and give my reactions, which I tried to do, particularly to prepare them for a lot of... intense feeling, which was really a misunderstanding. And I thought if I could save them from a lot of that, I would do the most good. And that was the part that General Dickman, who was there, thanked me. And Stimson and others liked the most. Anyway, the great German offensive broke loose March 21st and was going on at the time I lectured. The first day, the 21st, of course, we just got the news of the affair and a little bit of the extent of the affair. If you recall, the British Fifth Army was literally destroyed in the first part of this offensive, and a great gap was made in the line, and that's where General Debeney was moved from eastern France to command the new army forming in the gap in the vicinity of well, I've forgotten that. It was the peak of the great salient of the Western Front. The second day, the thing was getting very much hotter, we could tell that. The German advances were far greater than had been customary in trench warfare. They generally made very, very short advances, and they were getting larger. On the third day, they made deep advances, and we felt it at long, because an order came in relieving a British instructor to return immediately to his unit. I was called in by the officer in charge of the school, who later became chief of staff of the AEF, McAndrew, and asked to take over his job. And they didn't talk to the 1st Division or anything, and or at least I don't know what they did, but that is what way it came to me. So this man tried to tell me in half an hour what his whole course was, and I was to take over his course and teach that. So I went back from that, and I had no more than gotten in the classroom than another direction came for me to come back to the General McAndrew's office, and here was two more British officers, and I was directed to take over their two courses. So I retired with them, and they occupied about an hour and a half explaining their whole courses to me. I had this first man's course. Now I had two more. And damned if before I got through with them, a fourth man was relieved, and I got his course. So I had four Britishers' courses that I had to take there in a period of about 3 hours and a half. I came out so befuddled with data and everything, and I was trying to take over a Britisher's appreciation of this thing and technique of theirs, that it is altogether a very hard thing. However, that's the way it was. And that night at dinner, which I had with General McAndrew and General, his brigadier, more or less in charge of the instruction. I'll remember his name later. We talked this over quite a bit, and General McAndrew was very much concerned about it. And I was directed to leave. Then the next thing that happened, the next morning we were having breakfast, when an order came in for me to return to the very division, the 1st Division, immediately, and a car would meet me at north of Chaumont, at the near Domremy. And so in about half hour later, or less than that, because I got out as fast as I could, I left for the 1st Division, and I got up there and found it was just preparing to leave for the scene of the battle where the British 5th Army had been driven out and very badly handled. I remained with the 1st Division then until July, towards the middle of July that summer. And we moved immediately, going south of Paris, motoring. The troop trains were going south of Paris too, and on the motor trains and all were going south of Paris because there was too much confusion to the north of Paris in the supplying the French army and everything to meet this great German offensive. I know we spent the night at Fontainebleau, and I was very much taken back by the fact that we ate at the famous hotel there, outdoors, very charming, but we sat at the same table, four of us, that Mrs. Marshall and I had sat at not so long previously. Made quite a moving reaction for me. And the next morning we started again up the trail. We were now west of Paris, And we finally came into these assembly areas, as they called them. I learned a great deal about troop movements during this procedure, because it was a tremendous affair, and I thought perfectly beautifully done by the French in their handling of the railroads. The trains had come through, it seemed to me, at 10-minute intervals, and I would have to be at the train when it came in, because I didn't know who was on it, be a French division or part of a French division or part of the American division. And as the American division, I had to catch the fella and give him his orders as to where he was to march to after he detrained. So we had a very hectic time there, grabbing these trains as they came in. And if they were French, they went on off. And there were, as I recall, there were two or three French divisions moving through there at the same time, and the first division. And they were doing it without confusion. And it is a really a great demonstration of the highest form of troop management, and particularly as it's being done very hastily. So we got up near a place called G-I-S-O-R, G-Zor, and in the 1st Division, that was its center of concentration, and where we had our headquarters. And we stayed there several days and training in open warfare. And General Pershing was rather irritated by the French commander moving in and taking charge of the training. And we always had those difficulties, and the only way to do was just make the best you could of the affair. And of course, General Pershing and his staff were interested in a policy being established and not allowed to grow out of these affairs. And the French were intense on having American troops assigned to French divisions. So it had to be watched very carefully. So we had several big exercises there, and we had some regimental demonstrations there, and the French were there all over the place, rather supercritical. There was plenty to criticize. But these men that they were looking at and all in such a particular way did the most magnificent fighting later on, and I think the majority of them became casualties, because, as I recall, the 1st Division, which had an organizational strength of 25,000, I think, had a casualty rate of 26,000. And most of those normally would come out of the infantry, because the artillery didn't have anything like the casualties the infantry had, because they were further back as a rule. And so the infantry casualties were very, very heavy. And in one fight there, of the four colonels, one was killed. Of the four lieutenant colonels, all were wounded, and I think one or two killed. Of the majors, there were three to each regiment, and there were four regiments, which made 12 majors. Everyone was killed or wounded. They had took a terrific amount of casualties, but they went right straight ahead, and it was determining that, and the 2nd Division really did the determining stroke, which stopped the advance of the German army. Now, that's a rather strong thing to say, because the French were putting up a fine fight everywhere. The 3rd Division had gotten dragged into it there at Chateau Thierry and done a fine job there, got very little credit for it, because the Marines were referred to by name in one of the radios, and that turned all the publicity on them, whereas the 3rd Division at the crossing of the bridge and all at Chateau Thierry did a magnificent job and stopped the Germans. All this was a very exciting procedure, and it was, as I say, is a very interesting one. And so when we came north from Fontainebleau, we ran into a new army of the French. Not exactly, it was a group of armies. And I reported there, and we found out where the 1st Division was to go, and that was over G-Zor. And we got straightened out of that affair, but we learned a great deal about how they were handling these troops, and it was quite very instructive to see, and a tremendous battle problem to handle without confusion. The railroad part I've already described. The marching part came next, and I became heavily involved in that, when the movement of the 1st Division occurred from Gisors north to Frossy, which was north of Beauvais. And when we moved north there, I think we moved with 3 or 4 French divisions. And you had to be very particular about how you went about this thing. And there were some roads we weren't allowed to put certain units on. I remember there were a lot of the lighter metal roads that they didn't want the 155s on. And as I recall, our regiment of 155s went right on this road and just broke right through it all over. They got up there, but they did the terrible damage on the way up. It was all in the spirit of getting to the battle and getting up as soon as he could. And when he got up near Frossy and turned to our right, it was a very interesting thing to see, because the front was marked by observation balloons in any number right along. And as we went over from Frossy to where the 1st Division was going to commence its deployment, I found us in the middle of the deployment of the French aerial division, the only one they had. And that was reminded you a little bit of the Crusaders of old, when each fellow had his tent and his shield and coat of arms out in front, because the little tent fly covered his pursuit plane, and he was there. It was the French aerial division, and it was the great fighters of the French army. And the air was just full of these planes coming in and going out, and they had a terrible job on their hands. I came to know most of them quite well, and they were always anxious to get confirmations when they shot down a plane. And as a great deal of the shooting was over the 1st Division, they always had to come to the 1st Division observers on the ground to get confirmation of the fall of the German plane. And I'm not ashamed to say that I told our people to be very liberal, because the easier they could get confirmations over us, the more they'd fight over us, which was the case. Some of the things that came out later, the great French aces were there, and we came to know them well, because they'd always come into my section when they were trying to get a confirmation of a victory. And I was always very careful to treat them with great, in the most complimentary fashion. I remember one of the most famous ones, as the fighting died down a little bit, abated a little bit, we were finally allowed, two of us, to go off to Beauvais to get a meal. I was desperately tired, and I hadn't had any real rest for weeks and weeks. And General Bullard sent us off in order to get a good meal and get a change. And we were living underground entirely, and that's pretty depressing, in an old wine cellar, which was very deep, in which I tried to take Ms. Marshall in when I was over there visiting it from the meeting of the United Nations, and she wouldn't go at all. She didn't believe we ever lived down there. That was a palace in those days, because it was safe. Anyway, we went to the hotel in Beauvais, and this leading ace was at the table with a very beautiful girl. Of course, he was the great attraction to the women. He was the great hero, and they should have made a lot of him, because he's risking his life every day and in every way. And this girl was awfully good-looking. And he came over and spoke to me. And he met the others at the table. There were 2 generals. And one became chief of staff of the army, and one became a corps commander. And they were not at all loath to meet him. But the funny part of it was, and the reason I tell you is, we got away about 2 weeks later and went into Beauvais for a meal. And this time he was there with his fiancée and her mother, and the fiancé was anything but good-looking, but he was very courteous to her, and that was an arranged marriage, of course. She was going to marry the hero. I don't know what became of the pretty girl that he'd had 2 weeks previously. But when he looked at us, he winked at us, but didn't come over. Now I'm better look here and see what you've got down for me next. We learned a great deal about fighting up at this time. It is a continuous affair. Terrifically heavy artillery bombardment. The night was just hideous. I used to try to sleep upstairs in this chateau, but they drove me down. when they began hitting the building with these very 8-inch shells. That was just sounded like the end of the world. So I found out it was a more composed rest down in this deep wine cellar that I've already referred to. Then we had a very difficult situation. We had the first mustard gas attack, and that was a vicious thing. The brigade commander had directed the regimental commander at this town he sent word up to him to evacuate the town and go out into the fields in the woods. Well, it was raining hard, and shells were breaking all over the place. So this fellow preferred his dugout. And of course, the worst thing you can do with mustard gas is get in a wet dugout. That just permeates the whole business. And they were ordering him out, and he wasn't going. So I was sent up, the brigade commander didn't go, I was sent up from division headquarters with orders to relieve him. And that isn't very pleasant. Well, I had a hard time getting up there because I got shelled out about a dozen times. And the trouble is, when I'd lie on the ground, I'd lie in mud or something. And also, I was very much afraid of lying down in a mustard gas shell hole, which would have ruined me. But I finally got into the town, and that was a bad trip through the town because the blasting in the buildings is under very heavy artillery fire. I've forgotten the estimate of the number of shells in there. It was something appalling. And I finally got down to the dugout of the commander of the regiment, and I went right down in it and met him there, and he'd had a gas mask on then for about 10 hours. And that's a very exhausting thing. And they all looked very exhausted. And, of course, I came up to order them to do what they didn't want to do. And I was explaining to him that he didn't have much choice, that if he didn't choose to do it, I was directed to relieve him. And we were discussing that when a shell hit outside, right close to us. It just shook us up like jelly. And down the steps came a fella, rather fat-faced, jolly-looking, but he wasn't looking jolly. He didn't have a grin at the time. And he came sitting right down these steps and landed at the bottom. And his dugout had been blown up, and he had been blown out of it and found himself outside on the ground. Well, anyway, I'm getting near the end there.
Yes, sir, almost over.
Anyway, I was struggling with this man to make him understand that if he didn't do this, I had to relieve him. And unfortunately, I can't tell what happened. I don't remember now just what happened, except they had an awful battle about it.